So hi everyone, my name's Glenn, this is Kim. We're both from the Xamarin team, the Xamarin University team. And what we're going to do is we're going to tell you about Xamarin and how you can, really what you'll need to know in order to get up to speed with Xamarin and create great apps. So a little bit of background about myself. Slides, are we switching through?
Excellent. We are.
So I've been a Xamarin developer for roughly about 6 years when it used to be called MonoTouch and Mono for Android. I've been a part of the Xamarin team for the last 3 years, and I've been developing .NET apps since the .NET beta days. I love making mobile apps. It's one of my favorite things to do. I'm still doing it today, even though I'm part of Microsoft, knee Xamarin.
And I'm Kim Philpotts. I've been working at Xamarin for a few years as well before the Microsoft acquisition. And just like Glenn, I'm an instructor at Xamarin University. And I guess one of the big things that we get exposure to at Xamarin University is not only people who are starting out with Xamarin, but also some very experienced people as well. So what we want to cover off today is those things that you need to know to be a successful Xamarin developer. Because we see some good projects, we see some bad projects. And so we're going to be going through at a fairly rapid rate of knots, so we'll do questions at the end if that's okay. And as well, probably the one thing you want to take away from this talk is this link here, so aka.ms/10thingsxamarin. So this is going to be links to resources that we're going to point out throughout the talk, as well as some that we're not going to have time to cover as well. Now, for those cool kids who have a QR scanner, that link up there, I promise you, takes you to the same link. So follow that, and you'll find lots of great resources. But we might get started with our 10 things. Good. So over to you, Glenn.
Thanks, Kim. Well, one of the first things we often need to know when we're developing Xamarin, a lot of people think of Xamarin as Xamarin Forms. Xamarin Forms is actually a relatively new framework in the Xamarin space. It's only about 2 years old. But a lot of people who are new to it think Xamarin Forms is Xamarin. That's actually not the case. Xamarin Forms is a library built on the native platforms. So people will often decide, should I use Xamarin Forms or should I use Xamarin Native? What are the kinds of decisions I need to make in order to do this? So a good rule of thumb is to ask yourself a few questions. Is your app built for data entry? The name Xamarin Forms actually implies that it's all about data. So typically for data consumption or data entry kind of applications, Xamarin Forms is a good candidate. If you're building a prototype, Xamarin Forms is an excellent way to build an application prototype very quickly. And if you're more interested in cross-platform code, again, Xamarin Forms is a good candidate there. And it might be a good fit as that bottom point because you actually might find that after you go a little bit down the track, you might find that Xamarin Forms is not the right fit and you need to change. We'll talk about strategies around that a little bit later too. So the other mechanism is Xamarin Native. That's where you're writing Xamarin iOS apps or Xamarin Android apps. So often these are very rich media experience apps, things like games, things like media players, something like a Netflix app you'd write in Xamarin Native to get that very rich user experience. So in those cases, Xamarin Native is a better fit. Now, if you go down one path and choose Xamarin Forms or another path and choose Xamarin Native, you might actually find you made the wrong decision. And if that's the case, we actually recommend architecting your applications using the MVVM design pattern. We'll talk about MVVM a little bit later, but that allows you to switch between Xamarin Forms and Xamarin Native without losing a bulk of your code. Cool, let's go over to Kim.
All right, customizing. So one of the things about when you spin up a Xamarin Forms application is they can be a little bit plain to start with. And so it's important you understand the techniques that you have to add a bit of bling into your application, so how you can customize them. And we've actually got a variety of different techniques that we have here, right from the properties that we have that is exposed by Xamarin Forms through to writing our own custom renderers or even embedding native controls as well. Now, before we go through some of those strategies, let's talk about how Xamarin Forms, for example, actually creates native controls. So a little bit of Xamarin Forms 101, if you like. So basically what we have is you're going to create something like a button in Xamarin Forms. Now, what's interesting about this is this button is not visual at all. Okay, it's a model object. What happens is when you go and run this on a device, a thing called a platform renderer is going to go and take that button and it's going to turn it into a native control. So it's going to turn it into an Android widget button, for example, or on iOS it's going to turn it into a UI button, and on Windows it's going to use something like a system Windows button. And every control in Xamarin Forms has a platform renderer, and including any controls that you write are going to have a platform renderer as well. So that's a little bit of background, but let's talk now about how you can customize your applications. And kind of the first and the most obvious one is to use the properties that are exposed by Xamarin Forms. And you can actually do quite a bit here, right? So you can set colors, you can do the layout, you can set fonts and things like that. And the key thing you want to do is learn about the layout techniques and learn about those properties that are available to you. And if you are going to be, you know, setting properties here, a really good idea is to, instead of just sort of dumping fonts and colors all throughout your code, you want to consolidate those into resource dictionaries, okay? And then in your controls, you want to use those resource dictionaries. And this kind of adds a couple of advantages. First of all, it's going to provide some consistency in your application, okay, across your various platforms. It's also going to actually make your development life a lot easier because you don't have to be thinking about fonts and colors and things like that. Instead, you just remember a style and you go and apply that. And as well, you know, when your graphic designer comes along and says, yeah, I don't really like that green, you know, you can go and change it in one place. So properties and styles are a great technique. Now, the one thing that we often forget, or people often forget with Xamarin applications, is they're actually native applications. And so each of the platforms has an appearance API or a theming API built in. So in iOS, that's your UI appearance. On Windows, that's going to be your styles that are in Windows. And on Android, of course, we have all of the good material design stuff. So you can use this stuff to theme your application. Okay, so let's say you've got a simple UI like that. It's very boring, just out of the box. Let's say on iOS, we could use the UI appearance API, and we could set some tinting, and we could set some fonts. And just with a few lines of code like that, you're going to get a much more pleasant experience. So this is how you can theme things on a particular platform. All right. Let's talk about the next one, effects, which you may have heard of. So the idea of an effect is once the renderer spits out the control, the native control, it's then going to pass it on to effects. And so then effects can go and inspect that control, and it can go and set properties on it that aren't exposed by Xamarin Forms. And you can do a lot of great things in here. So basically the way this works is over in your shared code, you might go and create yourself an effect, let's say a shadow effect, and you go and apply this onto your Xamarin Forms control. So when the renderer spits that out, so in this case it's going to spit out, for example, a UI button, it's then going to pass that on to your effect. And so your shadow effect can then do whatever it needs to do, because that's actually platform code down there. So you can do whatever you like. And so effects are really cool because you can attach and detach them at runtime. You can implement them on one platform or all the platforms. What else is good about effects? What do you like about effects?
Well, I like the fact you can actually apply them against different controls.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I could take that same effect, I could put it on my button, I could put it on a label, so you can reuse it around the place. All right, and a really good place to have a look at this is this Forms Community Toolkit. So this is an open source library which has a whole bunch of effects already built in. So you can either go and just use those via NuGet, or you can go and pull them apart and see how to write an effect as well. Now, moving on from effects, you have these things called custom renderers. So this is where you want to take full control of the whole rendering process. And so they're a little bit harder to write than effects, but the basic idea is you've got two approaches you can use. One is you can derive from an existing Xamarin Forms control. So let's say you do that and you're trying to create a tri-state checkbox. So maybe you derive from a switch or a button, and you're going to inherit those properties and events and methods, and you can just basically customize it. Now, the other approach that we have with renderers is to actually derive from the ViewBase class. Okay, so in this case, you're not going to get any properties and methods and events. You have to create those bindable properties yourself. But that's kind of the preferred approach if you're trying to create a control that doesn't look like any Xamarin Forms controls at all. And the basic way that we write a renderer, I suppose, is first we create a definition of that control, so basically the model up in Xamarin Forms, so that would have your bindable properties and events and things like that. Down in the platform layer, you would create the code, the renderer, that is actually going to take that model, it's going to spit out that native code. And you would do that for all of your different platforms. Once you've done that, you can then go and basically consume that that control in your Xamarin Forms application. So, you know, renderers are really, really powerful. There's basically nothing you can't do with a renderer because you're down at that platform level in your actual code there. So, you know, if there's something you can't do in effects, perhaps a renderer is an approach that you can use. Now, sometimes there's a native control that's not exposed by Xamarin Forms that you want to use in your application. Let's say a floating action button in Android. And you don't want to write a renderer for it, you just want to bring it in. And so you really just want to say to Forms, just get out of my way, let me just jam this control straight in here. And so we can do that now with native control embedding. And so here you can see an example of actually bringing in some iOS controls into our Xamarin Forms structure. So this is pretty cool. Now, there's a lot of different options that we have then, right? And most well-styled applications in Xamarin Forms are going to use a variety of these techniques as well. So, you know, if you want to have consistent style across your application on different platforms, you would probably turn to the Form Style API. If you wanted to tweak a control on a particular platform, you might use effects. Maybe that will do what you're after because it's a slightly simpler interface than a renderer, or maybe you would create a renderer derived from that control. You know, if you wanted to create a totally unique control, you would create a totally new renderer based on a Vue-based class. And as well as that, you know, if you wanted to use a native control, you could just embed it, you could write a renderer around it. So there's a lot of different options that we have available to us. But what you'll notice is the whole spectrum varies from what's exposed by Xamarin Forms right down through to the platform code. So probably good if we talk about knowing the platforms.
Yeah, very good point. So even if you're building a Xamarin Forms application, you really want to take advantage of native features. And obviously, if you're building a Xamarin native app, you're working with iOS, you're working with Android, you want to take advantage of those great capabilities that are available on every platform. So just a refresher, if you're building a Xamarin native application, typically this is what your code structure would look like. You'd have some shared code that represents roughly around 70, maybe 75% of your application code base, and then you'd have some code that represents the user interface and the services and capabilities of each platform, iOS, Android, and Windows. Now, if you move to Xamarin Forms, the user interface is often shared between those platforms, so you actually end up with a larger amount of shareable code, roughly around 90 to 95%, depending on your needs. But at its core, you're still sitting on those native platforms on iOS, on Android, on Windows. So it's a good idea to know the native tools for when you're working with that platform. You might need to debug a particular issue. You might need to take advantage of some features that are available too. So we're going to run through some that you should be aware of on the various platforms. Now, on iOS, in order to use the Xamarin tools, you actually need to install Xcode. And so Xcode has associated tools with it as well. Instruments is a great profiling tool that you can use in order to analyze your application as it's running. So often we always have those issues of our application's not performing, we don't know why, and it's always the week before we have to ship it, right? And maybe just me, who knows. But Instruments is a great tool to do that. You can look at the CPU usage, where is it taking most of the time. You can look at file usage, you can look at network usage. If you're doing a GPS-based application, you can look at battery levels while the app's running. Lots of analysis that you can do there as well. Another tool that I like using for iOS is the Xcode hardware tools. That's a separate download from the Apple developer site, but allows you to do things like bring in the AirPrint simulator, so you can simulate printing to an actual air printer, and it'll save as a JPEG or PDF on your local file disk. And there's also the network link conditioner, which is really effective for testing what your application is going to be like on terrible networks. What's going to be like on a 4G, on a 3G, on somewhere where all the packets are being dropped, and you can use that quite effectively. On the Android side, you should be aware of the Android SDK manager. If you're using the Xamarin installer that comes with, or that's downloaded from the Xamarin website, or using it as part of the Visual Studio installer, often the initial SDK is already set up for you. But Android will release new versions of Android, or Google will release new versions of Android periodically through the year. And you'll need to apply those updates because often it's the tooling like the Xamarin designers that need those advanced toolings. Even the Xamarin Forms libraries are often built using the latest versions of those Android SDKs. So it's important to make sure those are up to date. So use the Android SDK manager, check it periodically and make sure it's up to date.
Yeah, and that's about half the problem that people have.
Absolutely, yeah. And you'll often find that they'll have not enough libraries on their local system, or they'll try and target another platform that they actually haven't downloaded yet. Now, likewise, the Android device monitor is just a way to look into your devices or simulators or emulators that are running, and you can look at the processes, you can look at the logging of what's happening on your Android device or simulator, you look at the running threads, the heap, you can look at how many Java objects are being created in your application, because Android actually has... When you're running a Xamarin Android application, you actually have two virtual machines running. You have the Android virtual machine and the Mono virtual machine running, and they need to communicate. So sometimes you might have issues on the Android side, and you want to diagnose that. The Android device monitor is a useful tool there. You can also do things like attach to the file system, copy files from that file system on the device, put files there as well. It's very useful. Also, it's a really good idea to take advantage of the platform features, the things that make your application pop or really useful. So on Android, things like Material Design is a great tool to use. In Xamarin Studio and Visual Studio, there is a theme design editor that you can use and customize that theme. There's one built into Android Studio you can use as well to define those schemes and then copy those into your projects. It's a good idea to understand the Google Services conventions. So when you're using things like maps or in-app purchases, there's particular patterns that emerge, how you authenticate with Google, what kinds of things you need to embed within your projects in order to make a facility like in-app purchasing working or mapping working. So they have a lot of rules around that. Also, Android actually has some really nice navigation features. There's a gentleman, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, Kim.
Martin Van Dyke?
I think so, yeah.
I think so.
He makes some great components. If you look at the screen up here, there's a control there called Folding Cell List View, where you tap on a cell and it expands out. There's lots of great capabilities you can do with animations and all sorts of things like that in Android. On the iOS side, it's a great idea to take advantage of the iOS features. iOS is very rich from a user interface point of view. You can take advantage of things like the Pencil on the iPad Pro to speed up things. There's HealthKit. So HealthKit is basically a storage mechanism of health-related data, and that might be fitness, that might be medical information. Apple actually store a lot of great details there. You can create extensions for the home page. You can create extensions for a range of other capabilities there. You might also use things like the multi-peer connectivity, having multiple iOS devices that connect to each other without the need for an actual established network. So there's little nuggets of gold all throughout the platforms that you should be taking advantage of. It's also a good idea to understand the various patterns of the platforms too. So on iOS, they use the model view controller everywhere. So you can't typically use one of the user interface mechanisms, whether it's iOS, whether it's watchOS, whether it's the tvOS, without actually using the model view controller. So that's represented by a class called UI View Controller in iOS. You should be aware of it. They also have another concept called a delegate. Now, I've been walking around, everyone's got the name tag saying delegate on them. I always think, as a C-sharp developer, does that mean they're a method to another person? Maybe not. A few C-sharp developers are chuckling at that. But the delegate concept in C-sharp is very different to the delegate concept in iOS. In C-sharp, a delegate is a pointer to a method. But in iOS, a delegate actually means it's an object that receives notifications and informs you of when things are happening. Things like when the application is appearing, when it's disappeared, when you're receiving a push notification, for example. That's the application delegate. And there's lots of other delegates that get notifications, so it's an established pattern that you should be aware of. On Android, they have different mechanisms again. They have a very loosely coupled architecture. So normally if you're coding desktop applications or other mobile applications, if you want to create a new screen, you typically create a new instance of that screen and present it. Android doesn't work like that. All the control is managed through Android. They have these concepts called activities, and activities represent the screen. And if you want to start a new activity, you have to tell Android that you'd like to through a concept known as an intent. And this is saying what I would like to present. And it might be an explicit screen that you're trying to create, or it might be, I just want this particular information displayed in a screen that can manage this kind of MIME type, like can it manage a geotag and show up in a maps application, for example. So you'll send the intent to Android. Android will then create that new intent and then show it. And it does this because Android will often close the originating activity down in order to conserve memory, because Android devices can actually be very small on memory and resources. The other concept in Android is the fragment. And the fragment represents typically something like a user control, where you just have some components and some behavior associated that you can embed into activities. Awesome. Over to you, Kim.
Yeah, so sharing code, right? So this is why a lot of people like Xamarin, is because this ability to share code. But the reality is that just because you've got a Xamarin project doesn't mean you're automatically sharing code. You've actually got to architect this to maximize your code sharing. So this is one of the things you need to know. And as Glenn mentioned, you know, all of our applications in Xamarin are actually native applications. And so they're always going to have some platform-specific code, right? That's inevitable. Whether that's Xamarin Native or whether it's Xamarin Forms, it doesn't matter. There'll always be platform code. The idea, though, is you want to keep that restricted to just things that access platform services directly or to things that access native controls that you have. The rest of your code should be shareable, right? And cross-platform. So of that shareable code, a portion of that is going to be your code that you produce. So your models, your view models, your business logic, all that sort of stuff. The rest of the shareable code is going to come from components that you might bring in. So if we have a look at what makes code shareable. So basically, any time you're not accessing a platform API directly, potentially that code is shareable, right? And particularly the things you want to focus on, things like accessing web services and databases and your business logic. You don't want to be writing that multiple times. You want to write it once in a shared place and then use it. Now, of course, the opposite is true as well, and that is any time you're accessing a platform API, of course, that code is not really shareable, right? Because you're actually down at the platform. However, that does not mean you cannot call that code from your shareable code. So this is what you need to be aware of, is how to call platform code from shared code. All right. So really there's sort of two basic structures you can use when you're developing a Xamarin application for sharing code. One is shared projects, which is essentially a glorified file linking, and you can use portable class libraries. And in the Xamarin community, there's normally fairly strong opinions on the right way of going. I can see Igor smiling, so he has one. It's kind of like our tabs versus spaces, really, when it comes down to it. So just out of interest, for those of you who develop in Xamarin, who is in the shared project camp? Give me a hands up. And remember, this is a safe space. We're not going to judge you. No? Nobody. Okay, who's in the portable class library side? Yeah, okay. So just about everyone, right? So just like choosing between a hard or a soft taco, right? It's all right. You can have both, right? It's fine. And even if you've got a preference, eventually you're going to work on a project that is not using your preference. So you need to know how to call that code. Now, from a shared projects perspective, one way you can do this is with conditional compilation. And this is okay for really, really simple things, right? So here there's a on-delete note method. It's got a bit of conditional code for iOS and a bit for Android. Now, the problem with this is it flies out of control pretty fast and ends up with spaghetti code. So this is, you know, I often don't use this, right? An approach that I use and I think is much better is to use partial classes. So the idea of a partial class is you split the definition of a class between two files. And so one half of it is going to sit in the shared project. The other half of it is going to sit down at the platform level, all right? And then essentially what happens is when we run this, they join together. And so now your shared code is calling down to your platform code, right? And you would do exactly the same thing for Android, all right? So this essentially gives us conditional compilation, but it's structured a little bit nicer, all right? So that's shared projects. Now, the other approach that most people prefer is portable class libraries. And the problem or the concern or maybe the challenge with portable class libraries is that the more platforms you want to support, the more restricted your API becomes. And so in those situations, you have to call down to the platform. Now, hopefully, you know, when .NET Standard rides in on its golden horse, then a lot more things are going to be available across all of the platforms. So there might be, you know, slightly larger API surfaces available to us. But you would essentially use the same strategy we're about to talk about to call down to that platform code. And that is, what you want to do is you want to create some form of abstraction for what you're trying to do. So let's say I wanted a dialer interface, right? I would create an interface sitting up in my portable class library, and that's what my shared code would use. And then I would create an implementation of that interface on each of my platforms, all right? And then the question comes, how do we resolve an implementation of that interface? And there's a couple of techniques that you've got here. So Xamarin Forms has this thing called the dependency service, which is built in. It's got a horrible name because it's not a dependency injection framework. It's actually a service locator. But anyway, the basic idea is we would create our interface up on that shared code. Okay? Then we would provide an implementation of that on each of our platforms. So here's our phone dialer iOS. We would register that with the dependency service. And then in our shared code, when we wanted to use that, we would use the dependency service to resolve it. Right? And so you notice the code here on the shared side doesn't have any reference to platform. It's just using the iDialer interface. And so effectively, it's going to call down to the platform. So this is one approach you can use. It's very simple. It's really easy to do, and it's fine for a lot of forms applications. Now, there's one slight issue with it, I think. Do you have any issues with it?
With that? Yeah, it actually gives you a dependency on Xamarin Forms.
Exactly, right? So now I'm using Xamarin Forms to do my resolution here. And so that means if I want to move away from Xamarin Forms later on, it's just one dependency I've got to get rid of. So often people will put that behind an abstraction itself. Or actually a technique that people will tend to use in bigger projects is dependency injection using containers. So it's a very powerful technique. The basic idea is we have a container, we register things with our container, very much like what we saw with the forms dependency service. And then we use the container to create our objects. So here we're saying, I've got this container, I want you to create me a main view model. And maybe that main view model uses this idialer that we have. And so what is going to happen is the container is actually going to have a look at that main view model. It's going to do a bit of reflection on it, and it's going to have a look and see that it uses an idialer. And then it's going to have a look at what's registered with it, and it's going to say, ah, I've got this phone dialer iOS that I can use. And so it's going to create that dependency for you automatically, and then it's going to go and inject that into your main view model there. So it's a little bit magical, right? A lot of stuff happening sort of behind the covers, but it's a very powerful technique, and it's really great if you want to make your code a little bit more testable as well. So there's a lot of containers out there. This code here is sort of a munged up version of AutoFac, but there's TinyOSC, there's Unity, there's a lot of containers out there. All right, so a good place to get a bit of information about these containers and how they fit in with Xamarin is that link that's on the slide. It's also in the GitHub repository that I gave you a link to earlier on. So that will give you an example of some code using IOC containers. All right, so the obvious question is which one should you use, right? Should I use shared projects? Should I use portable class libraries? And I'm going to say at the risk of upsetting some people, I think you can use both, right? Shared projects are a lot simpler when it comes down to it, right? And if you just need to call some API code, they're pretty simple. The problem with them, as I mentioned, is it sort of leads to spaghetti code, and it can be harder to test your application. So normally what will happen is as your applications get more complex or your teams get bigger, you'll start moving towards portable class libraries. There's more hoops to jump through, but it's going to enforce some architectural design on you, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You can also unit test these quite simply, and I suppose the biggest differentiator between the two is shared projects have to be shared at a source code level, whereas portable class libraries, you can bundle them up and basically deploy them. So what I use is sometimes I use shared project for the code that I want to share across platforms on a particular within a particular application. But if I've got something that I want to reuse across multiple projects, I might use a portable class library to do that. All right. Now, the second part of sharing is the components you might bring in. And there's a lot of great places you can get components. So NuGet is a fantastic resource. You know, it's got like a billion different components in there. They're not all guaranteed to work with Xamarin. A lot of them will. And for example, I was looking for some code the other day to find the distance between two geolocations. And, you know, there's a NuGet for that, right? There's a NuGet for everything, basically. The challenge is, though, that it's kind of like the Wild West of component delivery, right? So anyone can push anything up to NuGet, basically. So you need to do your due diligence. So another option that you have available to you is the component store. So what the component store is it's basically components that have been validated to work with Xamarin. And the real advantage here is when you download a component, you're going to get some sample code on how to use that component as well. So it's a really fast way of getting started. As well as that, it actually has a selling model as well. So if you're writing some UI and you want to package that up and you want to sell that, you can sell it on the component store as well and make some cash. Now, of course, there's third-party components as well. A lot of people are writing those. They're great for things like charting controls or, you know, really dynamic grids. So have a look at those. And probably the most interesting place for us as Xamarin developers is these Xamarin plugins. And who uses Xamarin plugins? Yeah, a few of you. Yeah, fantastic. So there's a lot of these I use. I use connectivity, geolocation all the time, media plugin if I want to select photos. And the idea of a plugin is it kind of abstracts out platform features into a shareable API that you can use. So you just go and you don't have to worry about the platform implementations of that. There's also a great little repository there called Awesome Xamarin, which lists out like a billion different things that are sort of verified to work with Xamarin. So that's a great resource as well. Yeah. Here's an example of using a plugin. So one that I've used is Fingerprint Scanner. Right? So let's say you want to enable fingerprint authentication or touch ID in your application. You can bring in the fingerprint scanner and literally with one line of code here, so authenticate async, right, that we'll call in our shared code, it's actually going to call down to the appropriate platform logic. And so for iOS, it's going to use Touch ID over on Windows, and on Android, it's going to use a fingerprint scanner. And you basically get a result back to say, hey, is it authenticated or is there too many attempts? So that's an example of how you use plugins, and you know, you use them quite a bit as well.
I do. My talk tomorrow, I'm using plugins for probably a lot of the functionality. It just simplifies everything.
Yeah, it pretty much means you can focus on your business. Mm. All right. Now, this brings us to one other thing about how you structure your application, because this can impact on sharing and your ability to move around platforms as well. Okay, so MVVM is a model. A lot of Xamarin Forms is sort of based on MVVM. Who's using MVVM? Yeah, most of you? Yeah, so the idea is it's very separated, right? You've got your view model, your model. And there's some knowledge about this, like your view model knows about your model, your view knows about your view model, but the opposite is not true. So your view model doesn't know about your view, right? So what you can hopefully do is you can make your view very dumb, right? And just basically display what it, you know, it doesn't really know what it's displaying necessarily. And it uses data binding from your view model. And what this allows you to do is it means that you can unit test most of your application, basically. And you would want to do things as well, like move your code behind, like your events behind your views into commands that you put in your view model. And that means you can test actually what happens when button clicks happen, for example, without having to spin up your UI. And navigation as well is another thing you probably want to put into your view models as well. Now, of course, MVVM is not necessarily for everyone, right? It's got some definite pros and cons. The biggest advantage, I think, is it provides a really highly testable surface area for your application. So you can pretty much test, you know, I don't know, pick a percentage, 80% of your application with unit tests. Okay. It also centralizes a lot of your business logic and things like selection behavior and navigation behavior you can put into there. And it does take advantage of the binding infrastructure, which means you don't have to be moving things in and out of controls. It sort of just automatically happens for you. However, it does require a little bit of infrastructure as well. So if you've just got a very, very simple application, it may not be the right strategy for you. But you find for a lot of applications, it's pretty useful because it gives you that basic structure to build your application with when you begin. Now, you notice here on the negative side, I've also mentioned bindings, right? And the reason why is because bindings are awesome when they work. And when they don't work, they sort of just fail silently. So you need to have a pretty good view of or understanding of bindings, and you know sometimes they can be a little bit hard to debug as well. So a thing to know is a lot about the binding infrastructure. Okay, so let's have a look at just a really simple project structure here. So a bit of a generic one. You notice there's sort of three sections here. There's the host projects, there's the shared code, and there's the test projects. So the very first thing you want to do, you know, when you spin up a Xamarin Forms application, or you know any application actually, whether it's Xamarin Forms or not, is create yourself a project which is going to have your models and your view models and your business logic in it, and make it totally independent of your UI. Okay, so don't have any forms dependencies on there or iOS dependencies in there. And the idea of that is that we can then, if we wanted to move, for example, a forms to something else, or you wanted to put a WPF interface in front of this thing, you can do that without having to rewrite parts of your application or decouple it. Now, the next thing you're going to have is you're going to have, let's say, a Xamarin Forms library, which is going to go and reference that core library in there. So that's where all your Xamarin Forms code would go. And we're going to have these host projects as well. So this is where platform-specific code would go. And these are the actual applications that we run, essentially. Now, down in the test area, right, because we all test our applications, I know. And one of the great things about MVVM is that we can unit test a lot of our applications. So you want to write unit tests for your core logic in here, your core assembly, and you'll be able to test your navigation, you'll be able to test, you know, potentially selection, all of your business logic, what happens behind buttons, for example. And another thing you'll want to do is you want to write UI tests as well. Okay, so these are the things that actually spin up the UI and have a look at how it appears on different devices. And this is really, really important for mobile applications because we run on such a variety of different devices. So actually seeing how they render on different devices is really a crucial part of testing. And as well as that, there's an application I really like in terms of a structure, and that's the Xamarin Evolve app. So this is kind of a really nice reference architecture, I find. It's not overly complicated, but it does have pretty good separation. So it's a good one to pull down and pull apart and have a look at how that works.
It's now, a good example. Sorry. I was going to say, it's a good example of not only sharing code between our mobile platforms, but it actually has some code shared between the mobile and their web project too.
Yeah, absolutely. So it has the Azure backend in that code, and they use the same model objects and things like that between their client and their server. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really good reference app. You want to know about the good frameworks that are available. Now, Xamarin Forms was built with MVVM in mind, really. There's a few parts where it doesn't have it entirely covered, and that's where some of these frameworks come in. Now, having said that, I've seen some like magnificent train wrecks of applications where people have just sort of jammed frameworks in for no apparent reason. They weren't really sure of why they were putting it in. They perhaps read a blog and they thought, oh, it's a good idea, I should always use MVVM Cross or something like that. Now, Xamarin Forms has most of the MVVM stuff in there. Libraries like Fresh MVVM are pretty lightweight. It's written by Michael Ridlon, and it's designed to sort of fill the gaps that is missing in Xamarin Forms. Now, there's another one as well if you're writing larger enterprise applications, written by another Australian guy called Adam Pedley. So this is XRIN. So XRIN is for larger enterprise, large-scale applications. And for native applications, very popular libraries are MVVM Cross, MVVM Lite. So they're used, primarily for native, but people use it for Xamarin Forms as well. And we've also got Reactive UI. Now, I don't personally use Reactive UI, but Glenn would slap me if I didn't.
No, it's my favourite.
It's your favourite?
It is my favourite.
Why?
Well, because it's functional. It allows you to speed up access. I've got one application that I wrote that had input from 8 sensors. And I was using MVVM Lite beforehand, and it was just a mess in order to structure. But Reactive UI, it's more of its reactive components that allowed me to streamline all that information and flow it through elegantly. So I had probably about two-thirds of the code, but a significantly more elegant solution.
Yeah. So if you're a functional programmer, if you know F-sharp, it's probably your friend.
I do a bit of F-sharp.
All right. Let's move on. Let's talk about sort of the UI aspect of MVVM.
Awesome. So if you're doing Xamarin Forms applications, ideally you should be using XAML for your user interface. Who here knows XAML either from Xamarin Forms or WPF or Silverlight? Yeah, fair few of you. Well, if you're not doing Xamarin development now with Xamarin Forms, you're going to find this really easy to work with. It's the same XAML, they just have a different object layer that you're working with, which is Xamarin Forms. XAML at its core is an object serialization technology. It converts the XML into user interface objects. For example, you can see on there we've got a content page which represents a screen, a stack layout which represents a layout of controls, and a number of other controls like labeled entries and a couple of buttons. Now, the element objects actually create objects. It's like writing in code new object, and in this case, new stack layout, when it sees that stack layout tag. And all the attributes will actually represent properties within those objects or elements within those objects. And in addition to that, the children relationship between those objects often represent ownership. For example, the label entry and two buttons are owned as children on the stack layout. So it's pretty easy to have a look at that and actually see what the user interface is. Now, there's lots of great reasons to use XAML. If you've ever had a lot of code where it had user interface and behavior mixed in together, then that actually gets a mess to debug and maintain. So XAML allows that clean separation of moving the presentation into a separate place. So if you need to alter behavior, you only go to where the behavior needs to be altered. You don't have to mess with both and test for both in order to do that. That saves you a huge amount of time. So this is what that XAML would look like if we'd migrated it separate to the behavior. We've just got XAML that represents the details of what we're linking into within our code base. And in this case, we're looking at a particular object and binding those details to it. We'll talk about binding in a second. Another great reason to use XAML is we now have the XAML previewer. Solid. Kim likes the previewer a lot.
I can't work without it anymore.
Yeah, it's a great tool. And we're allowed, not we're allowed, but you can actually see the preview for iOS and Android as a phone or as a tablet as you're actually typing out the XAML. So before this, what we would have to do is we'd have to make some edits to our XAML, run the application, wait for the simulator to appear with our application and its changes, have a look, see if it fixed it, and then go back. This allows us to just edit it in real time and see the presentation. It saves you so much time.
And there's some pretty cool things you can do with that as well. Like you can put designer data into it as well.
True.
And it's a little bit different to some of the other XAML preview technologies. Like there's Gorilla Player, which is fantastic as well. But this is actually a sort of a running simulator. So if you've got like renderers or things like that, they'll render out into here as well.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's not a designer. We don't have a designer yet, but it's the next best thing. Now, some other reasons to use XAML is we have the XAML compiler. So initially when XAML Reforms was launched, what would happen is that the XAML would be shipped with a portable class library that was part of our application. And at runtime, when we needed to display a screen, it would actually load that XAML from an embedded resource, pass that XAML, and then actually create the user interface controls. That was very slow. In XAML Reforms 2, we introduced the XAML compiler, which actually just compiles the XAML at compile time and then actually makes it nearly as fast as writing the code to create the user interface. And that speeds up the application quite considerably. I remember there was a couple of people at a local user group that I run in Brisbane who came in and they were having performance issues. They were using XAML Reforms 1.3, and the advice we gave at the meetup was to make sure you upgrade to XAML Reforms 2, turn on the XAML compiler. There's a couple of other things, and we'll talk about in the performance section, but they came back a month or two later, and they had significant performance improvements within their application. So lots of advantages there. And we do it because we're civilized people.
We are.
We understand separation of concerns. Now, another important thing to know about when you're doing XAML is data binding. And data binding saves you a huge chunk of time. Who's used data binding in WPF or XAML Reforms for that matter? About the same people as before. So data binding links your objects into your user interface. So you don't have to go through that process of copying all the properties over to your user interface controls properties and then listening for events and pushing it back. In fact, you'd probably have a model that looks like this. This is the old and slash bad way. You'd have a model class, something like a person object, and a user interface with lots of controls. And then you'd have to actually just copy all those properties over. And this was just filling out forms in triplicate, really. And you want to avoid this kind of behavior. And it's difficult to maintain the larger the object gets. Now, in the data binding world, what you have is a binding engine that sits in the middle that essentially performs that same behavior. But you don't have to do it now, which is good. And you essentially put all the binding mechanisms into the XAML rather than having to put it in the code. And that saves you a huge amount of time. It makes it more maintainable, makes it more readable also. Yeah. And a much better situation. Another thing, if you're doing XAML Reforms, that you should be aware of is the content views. And content views represent something similar to a user control if you're coming from the WPF world, where you can basically just have kind of a subscreen, which has a range of controls and also associated behavior with that. And then you can reuse that in other places, in other screens, in other subviews, in other content views within your application. So you can see an example here on the screen where we have a stack layout which has a name, email, and phone and a button. That just represents some controls that we might put in several places throughout our application. And if we want to embed that in, say, a content page, we need to reference the local namespace. You can see there on the fourth line where it's referencing the local namespace, just referencing to a CLR namespace. And then there's a line there, local customer view, which is really referencing that control that we've created. And because that's a XAML element, it's creating a new instance of that, and we're also setting the background color so you can kind of see which particular object
it is. And you can compose your UIs out of those various elements.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely. In more complex applications, you'll want to have as much reuse, and using content views is a great way to do that.
All right, so the next thing is storing data, because all your applications are going to store data eventually. And so we've got some options both locally and remotely that you want to know about. And essentially, if you think about local data, there's sort of three places you can store this stuff. There's preferences. Each of our devices actually have a file system on it, so you can write to the file system, you can work with loose JSON files or XML files and system.io.file if you like. And there's databases as well. Right? So these are our options. If we have a look through these, first of all, preferences. Now, you could go and write preference code on a platform-by-platform basis. I would say unless you've got a really, really, really good reason to do that, you instead just make your life easier and you use this settings plugin from James Montemagno, because what it's actually going to do is it's actually going to store things in the right place on each of those platforms. And so it's going to integrate with all of the nice device or the platform features that you have. So this is a great place to store preferences, essentially. Now, on the file system side of things, we can use our .NET API, so we can use system.io.file. However, system.io.file is not available in portable class libraries. You actually have to call down to the platform in order to do that. Now, there is an abstraction, a plugin as well, that allow you to do that. But the key thing to know about this is that different platforms store things in different places. The one that's the gotcha, and we've seen lots and lots and lots of applications.
iOS?
Is iOS, yeah. So iOS has two places you can store things. There's first the documents folder, which is where user-generated content goes. And that's available to the user, so the user can see that. And you've also got a libraries folder, which is where the system-generated stuff would go. So, for example, your database file would go in there. Now, if you put things in the wrong space, I promise you Apple will reject your application. And I think we've had a few rejected as well.
One of our conference apps for Xamarin, I think, a long time ago, the initial submission was rejected because of that very feature.
Yeah, so it'll totally happen. But, you know, you can work with files on the file system. Not a problem at all. Now, what about databases? Pretty much the default database for mobile applications is SQLite. The reason for that is because SQLite is deployed with iOS and it's also deployed with Android as well. I would recommend using this library here, SQLite-net-PCL. So it's a fantastic NuGet package that allows you to access SQLite databases in a cross-platform way. So you can basically share all of your code to do your database access. Now, it's a very small object relational mapper, which means that you can use your model objects for your tables and just mark them up with attributes. So anyone who's done Entity Framework, very, very similar sort of concept there. And it also does like database upgrades and things like that. It has link support, which is great. It also has async support as well. And so this is really important because when you do a query, you never want to block the UI thread, right? Just like any UI technology. And it's going to basically spin that out on a separate thread for you and go and perform it, and it's not going to block your UI. So definitely want to go and use this one. Now, we often move towards cloud storage. So for remote storage, the thing to remember is that on a mobile device, networks change. They come, they go. So you've got to deal with it, right? And really, probably the best way to do that and detect your changes is using the connectivity plugin. And you want to degrade gracefully. So it depends on what that means for your application. So for some people, that means that basically the app can't be used. For others, it's perhaps reduced functionality. For others, it might mean using offline storage. So again, you want to test this stuff. You want to simulate bad networks. This network link condition is a great way of doing that on iOS. On Android, the Android simulators allow you to specify what the network speed is. You'll also find a lot of proxy allow you to simulate this stuff as well, like Charles Proxy. You can simulate bad networks as well. And you know, with remote storage, performance matters. So you want to cache as much data as you can. And a very good way of doing that is using a library called Akavash. So you know, if you've got a lookup table, don't go and call and get to it. You know, get it each time. Get it and just put it on your local device and then access it from there. And also with using HTTP client. HTTP client by default uses the .NET stack, right? Which means it's going to be sort of calling through a few layers. Instead, you actually want to use the platform networking, right? So it's going to use the hardware acceleration on each of those devices. And so you want to turn on native optimizations. You can do that now in the project options. And you also want to make it nice and easy on yourself. So use some libraries like Refit, which is what I use if I'm going to be calling a RESTful service. It makes it dead easy to write code for that. Poly is a fantastic library as well for doing retries automatically. And I mentioned Akavash as well. And this URL that's on the slide here, Resilient Network Services, is a really great read that talks about how you can combine these things together to create a really robust network layer as well. All right. And, of course, hopefully you're using Azure. You can get this Azure Client SDK. It makes it dead simple to use. You're going to get a lot of features here. So you're going to have access to the data. As well as that, you'll have things like offline syncing that you'll get in there as well. It'll have authentication, so through OAuth providers, also through Active Directory if you're after that. And notification. So all of this stuff is really dead simple to bake into your application. And you've got a talk on this tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. Right? About three o'clock or so, and we'll be going through all these features.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I want to talk about there. Let's talk about performance.
Awesome. So performance is one of those things that if you have a problem, you definitely know it's happening in your app. Now, when you're developing with the Xamarin tools, you're developing on the mono platform, and the mono platform is very similar to the .NET. So .NET rules still apply in your application. If you've got some memory that you're holding on to, that's still going to be a memory leak in the .NET world. So be aware of that. Also, it's very smart to use caching. When we're using mobile devices, they're not desktop computers. They don't have as much CPU, and they don't have enough, as much memory. So you have to be very frugal, I would say, in dealing with the resources that you're acquiring and holding on to. So use caching where possible. Caching will be a theme over this particular section. There's also some other classes that you can use that are very useful, things like the lazy class. Lazy doesn't mean it does nothing. Lazy actually refers to a design pattern called lazy loading. Sorry?
I said don't judge me.
Don't judge you? No, that's fine. Lazy loading is basically load on demand, so only populate this object when you actually need it, and that's going to reduce the total memory load on your objects. Also, make sure you use async await. You don't want to block the main thread from running. And also know about perceived performance. If you know something is going to take a long time, bring up a screen that's saying it's loading. It's going to take a few seconds in order to work with that, and users are actually more comfortable with that process. Kim was talking about SQLite.net before. Almost all my applications that I've ever shipped to the App Store, minus two of them, have used SQLite as a data storage mechanism. So it's actually a really good general-purpose database, but there are some performance things you should look at if you're using it. So it is a database, so general rules apply again. Only take the data you need. You don't want to actually ask the database to give you all the table, bring it back into your app, and then filter it locally within your app. That's just a waste of time and resources. Also, SQLite forces that every operation is done within a transaction. And if you don't supply one, it's going to create one for you. So if you've got 50 to 100 operations, there's 50 to 100 transactions. That's going to increase the time it takes in order to execute that. It's best to supply a transaction, and that way SQLite's going to perform a little bit better. Now, another thing that might be a bit surprising, but SQLite has links, or SQLite.net has link support, which is a really great way of creating access to data within your projects. The problem with that is it uses Reflection behind the scenes. Reflection doesn't perform too well on mobile devices. So if you think about what happens if you're using Link, Link will look at your link queries, it'll try and work out what SQL it needs to generate, then send that to the database and execute. If you already know the SQL, you can miss a few of those steps and speed up the access. I've personally found in my applications, if I go from Link to direct SQL, I normally get about a 30% reduction in execution time. And also, if you've got very simple data needs, SQLite.net may not be the answer. You might want to use Akavast just for some simple key-value storage. Now, if you're dealing with images, images are very prevalent in mobile applications. There's a few things you want to consider. Obviously, caching is important. If you don't want to have to go and hit a website every time you want an image, if you're going to constantly use a particular image from a location, download it once, cache it. Xamarin Forms actually has built-in image caching in that if you're downloading from a URL, it'll actually cache it locally on the disk for one day. In fact, you can tweak that time out and make it last a little bit longer, which works nicely for an offline cache. But you'll also want to resize the images. If you're downloading a massive image but you're displaying it in a 40 by 40 window in a list view cell, then obviously not only is that going to be a waste of resources displaying it, it's going to need to recalculate and resize that image every time you scroll through and see that image. So it's better to resize for the format that you're working with. There's a great library called FFImage, which allows you to resize things on demand and has some very smart caching in there. On the Android side, and I'm saying Android here because iOS actually has built-in image caching, so it's a lot easier and smoother to use, but Android doesn't have one. They've got the aptly named Tango and Cache library, if you remember that. Sylvester Stallone movie. Do you remember that movie?
80s reference?
80s reference. I am very 80s. Cool. Now, on the Xamarin Native side, you want to dispose of objects that hold on to native things. In the mono runtime, if you're looking at something like a UI image in iOS, it might appear to be something like 32 bytes. But that UI image might be referencing a native object that's holding onto an image, which is 4 meg in memory. So it's a good idea if you're releasing it, don't leave it up to the garbage collector to deal with it, dispose of it straight away and get those resources back, especially if you're dealing with lots of images, lots of resources. And that actually goes for files too. I dealt with a project a few years ago where I was dealing with lots of files being uploaded to a centralized server. And what I found is that iOS had a limit of 150 open files on the platform. And once I reached that limit, it would actually say, no, you can't do anything more else and the app would crash. So sometimes you have to think about the strategies that you use on those native platforms. And you may not know that information going in. Just going back there. Also understand how to read the SGEN heaps. SGEN is the garbage collection mechanism that's used by Xamarin iOS and Xamarin Android. By default, the debug information for SGEN will appear in Android, but it won't appear in iOS. And you can look at that. And you can, if you learn how to read the numbers, you can see where objects are not being released back into garbage collection, where you have a potential memory leak. So it's very good to understand the SGEN. And the garbage collection.collect is not always a code smell. In Android, it's often very necessary. In order to release those native objects back into memory. On the Xamarin Form side, Michael Ridland had that talk this morning about performance, fast and beautiful applications, and he covered a lot of this as well. So you should ideally learn the optimization techniques for Xamarin Forms. A lot of it comes down to making sure you're using the XAML compiler, using the appropriate recycling pattern for list views. Always have the recycling on, in my opinion. How to optimize the layouts, so things like using the grid instead of stack layout, especially avoiding things like nested stack layouts. Don't use the recycler layout. I'll probably add that into Michael's talk. The relative layout. The relative layout I actually quite like using, but only in pages, but not in list views.
That's right.
And optimizing the images and text, which we've kind of discussed. Android, for example, doesn't have the concept of vertical positioning, so Xamarin Forms has to actually calculate that. So there's little strategies you can look at in order to take advantage of that. We've got a link in there to the Xamarin Forms performance site where you can learn a little bit more. And obviously learning profiling is very important. So speaking of profiling, there's a few tools that you'd want to learn how to use. Now, I mentioned Instruments before, a great profiling tool for iOS. Likewise, the Android Device Monitor, another tool that you can use to profile. The Android Device Monitor only profiles that Android side of the virtual machine. On the .NET side with Mono, then you'll need other tools. You'll need to use something like the Memory Analysis, also known as HeapShot, which comes with Xamarin Studio, and you can actually find that from the project menu. And there's also the Xamarin Profiler, which is part of the enterprise suite of Visual Studio. The Xamarin Profiler is probably the best option for profiling Android applications built with Xamarin Android at the moment. Yeah. Now, also, there's the Visual Studio Profiler. If you're used to that, you're comfortable with it, use it. One of the advantages and one of the things I love about doing profiling in cross-platform applications is that you've got all these platforms to choose from. If you like a particular tool, for a long time I used Instruments, I would often profile with Instruments, get the benefits of doing that profiling with that tool, but then I'd find that would flow onto my other platforms as well because they're using the same shared code. So it's a pretty good mechanism. So who has crashes in their application? No one?
Me. Someone?
Oh, we're laughing. Yeah, I know. We always often have issues with our application, and testing is an important thing, and it's especially important in the mobile application space. Do you have crashes in your application, Kim?
Constantly,
yeah. It's the process. I always think programming is the art of writing code. Debugging is the art of getting those bugs out there. Now, you always put bugs in your code. I do anyway. I think I stuffed up that statement. So in mobile platforms, you have unique challenges. So if you're used to desktop applications, if you're used to server applications, you often have a very good network. You have some good infrastructure around that. Mobile, you're constantly moving. You're going in and out of networks all the time. You've got issues with fragmentation. If I submit an Android 2.3 application to the Google Play Store, Google will tell me that there's about 10,000 types of devices that could run that app. Now, I don't have access to that many apps, so I need to develop strategies to test for that situation. And different devices will have different capabilities, even something like an iPhone and an iPod Touch, very similar. The iPod Touch won't have things like a GPS or probably use Wi-Fi location. It won't have the phone capabilities. And there's lots of little permutations and variations on those kinds of things you need to test for. Now, on the Xamarin platform, ideally you should know how to use NUnit. My personal favorite framework or test harness to work against is Microsoft Test, but mechanisms like NUnit is required for the Xamarin Test Cloud, which we'll talk about in a little bit of time. And also, as Kim mentioned before, you should be structuring your applications, ideally using MVVM, to encourage testing within your application too. Now, there's a great tool that was recently released called the Xamarin Test Recorder, and allows you to build test scripts just by using the app. So you can see on the screen here, what I've got is I'm actually just using the app on the right-hand side. And on the left-hand side, it's generating the UI acceptance testing code to create. So I can just go through a series of steps. Here I'm just saying I want some Tim Tams, get all the flavors, and then submit that, and it'll create the appropriate code for me on the left-hand side. And I can actually just use that code, copy that into my test project, or you can actually use the test recorder and upload it directly to Test Cloud to test it on a wider number of devices as well. I think most people will actually just move that code into another tool in order to use, but it's very effective as a way of creating tests. But if you're using Xamarin UI Test, which is a user interface acceptance test framework, it's basically very similar to the normal tests that you create. You have this arrange, act, and assert step. The arrange basically sets everything in play. Now, in the case of UI Test, that basically means what I'm doing is I'm setting up my application. So I'm installing a fresh copy of my application and starting it. And the act is basically the steps I want to do, what controls to tap, what text to enter, what gestures to make on the device. And the assert part is really seeing that the steps that I've done resulted in the changes and the outcome I wanted. So I can look at the user interface, query the user interface, and then say, well, does it have this particular text? Is this control visible? Is this control visible? Invisible? Those kinds of things. And there's plenty of operations you can do with UI test. So here's some of the common ones. You can tap on particular controls. You can see that the parameter to the tap method is really just passing in what we call a selector. So it's kind of very similar to the CSS selector model. And you'll just basically say, here's the attributes of the object I'm trying to find. And it might be I want an object with this particular text or an object of this particular class type. So on that third option, you can see that's a UI label. That's an iOS control I'm looking for. You can enter text. This last one's kind of interesting because it's actually looking at an embedded web browser within your application. And so what you can do is you can, in situations like OAuth, where you're authenticating against something like Facebook, you can actually query into that web page and say, okay, there's the username, there's the password, let's put the username and password in there, authenticate against the service and go back to our application. And you can automate those parts as well. There's a cheat sheet you'll find in the document yep. as well. So normally what you do after you have those reference tests, that reference test implementation, is you'd upload it to Xamarin Test Cloud. And Xamarin Test Cloud has thousands of devices. So I took this screen capture about 2 weeks ago. So we had just under 2,500 real devices. And they are real devices. I've been in the testing facility in Denmark where they've just got racks and racks of these amazing devices. For me as a gadget lover, I would just love to live there. But there's all variations of Android devices, of iOS devices, of varying types and also varying versions. So you can say, here's my application. What's it going to work like on all these versions of a platform? Now, going back 4 years ago when I submitted one of my apps to the App Store, there was really only a couple of variations. There was the iPhone and iPad and the orientations and not too many versions. And these days, there's actually the iPhone, the iPod Touch, there's the iPhone, different sizes of something like the 4S, the 5, the 6, the 6S, all those subtle variations as well that you have to test for. And then also the iOS versions and combinations of those. So it allows you to give this level of comfort that your app is going to work on a wider range of devices.
And it's the same tests, right? That you run locally, you just upload them.
It is. It's the same reference test, that's right. So once you actually upload it, you'll see a system a little bit like this. This is a test I created a few months ago where I had a basic quiz application. I wanted to run it through Test Cloud. I just picked about 5 devices just for simplicity, and I essentially said, here's the test I want to run. Run through all of them on these devices and see the outcome. And you can see the tick marks next to the various tests. So they were all successful. If they were if they failed, there'd be like a red lightning bolt, and you'd go in there and have a look at the details, and you'd be able to click on that particular screenshot of the device that failed, have a look at the CPU, have a look at the memory, see how the CPU and memory changed over time. You'll be able to look in the stack trace and see what was the actual issue that caused that particular problem. You'll be able to click on information about the device and see information like that device might only have 256 meg of memory, and maybe it was running out of memory, which is why that failed, or it might be a particular manufacturer of a device. So you can pin down what's actually going wrong through that testing process as well.
All right, so let's talk about one last thing, which is knowing where to get good information, right? Because it used to be back in the day, you'd download a book, right, and this would tell you pretty much everything you needed to know. And I would argue that these two books are still probably the most important ones. But, you know, so much of our information is online these days. And you can't always trust what's online. You might be aware of this. Not everything is true. There are alternate facts. So Scott Hanselman coined an interesting phrase where he talked about the internet as basically the bathroom wall of code. So you can't necessarily trust everything you find on the internet. And that's why it's important to understand the good resources. And the first one is the official Xamarin documentation. Why this is useful, it has lots of guides and recipes in there. Most importantly, it's always updated. So we have a docs team who are constantly updating this to keep up with the latest technologies. We have these things called pre-built applications. So these are full applications you can download, pull apart. It'll include often the client and the server side of things. So if you want to have a look at an app structure or you want to see how something's done from a UI perspective, these are really great places to go. We also have like a million samples as well that you can go and access. So as well, and I've got to put my plug in here, you can also go to Xamarin University, right, and get a free 30-day trial, right, and do live classes. We've also got self-guided learning. We have these guest lectures as well, which are fantastic. So we'll get like the creators of MVVM Cross and MVVM Lite to go and introduce and talk about their technologies. And of course, you can get certified as well. As well as that, blogs and podcasts, we blog every single day about new things happening in the Xamarin world on the Xamarin blog. If you're into podcasts, a good one to listen to is the Xamarin podcast, or Merge Conflict is another really great podcast to have a listen to. James Montemagno now has a show on Channel 9, MSDN. Check that one out. And there's a whole bunch of community stuff, right? So the great thing about Xamarin and .NET is we've got a really strong community. So there's this thing called Planet Xamarin, which we've recently sort of basically relaunched. And Planet Xamarin is really like an aggregator of all of the community blogs for Xamarin. So it's your sort of one-stop place to get all the blogs from MVPs and Xamarin staff and just community bloggers around Xamarin. And what's really nice as well is if you blog about Xamarin, then you can have yourself registered here. So it's actually a really good way of getting your blogs noticed out in the Xamarin community. So check that one out. As well, if you like to chat with other developers, there's some really interesting discussions happening on the Xamarin chat. There's us on the Slack community. So there's literally thousands of developers on there. So it's a great place to get a little bit about feedback or ideas of how to do things. And there's also the weekly Xamarin newsletter as well. So this is a really good resource to stay up to date. So there's some of the resources that I will use. There's also meetups around the place now. So we've got Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and we've just introduced Perth as well. So go along, meet some other developers, exchange ideas and whatnot. So that's kind of the 10 things that we wanted to cover. There was a lot more that we wanted to cover, but we're really sort of a little bit short on time. So we can continue our learning path here with some links that we have there. As well as that, you want to make sure you fill in your evaluation. So as you get an opportunity to crash a drone into the wall or do whatever you've got to do, if you get a pilot's license, that is. And very importantly, there's that link. There's literally hundreds of links in there in that GitHub repo, so 10 things Xamarin. So go and have a look at that. Everything that we've mentioned in today's session and as well as a whole bunch more. And, of course, you can find Glenn and I. We're going to be hanging around the conference. Come and have a chat with us. My Twitter handle is @kphilpott, so always feel free to come and have a chat. Send me a tweet. Yeah. Glenn?
Likewise, mine's Glenn T. Stevens. But we'll be around answering questions in the speaker's lounge after this as well. But we've got time for questions. I think we've got about 10 minutes.
I think we've got a few minutes. Yeah.
We do.
Any questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
In Android, normally when you embed native controls, you tend to have a fallback position. So if I was embedding something like the floating toolbar button in Android, my fallback would be to use the actual toolbar within a content page.
Yeah. So remember that XAML code, it had iOS colon, and the namespace was like UIKit, right? So it's smart enough, you can have an Android namespace there as well, and it will actually choose between the two. And so the challenge with native embedding is you end up with some crazy namespaces going up the top. So normally the technique that most people are using is to separate your Android stuff out into a content view and your iOS stuff into a content view, and then your page is actually iOS this one, Android that one. and it will actually dynamically select the right one for you.
Yeah. Cool, good question. Yes, we have a question at the top. I've always found it's a personal preference. A lot of people coming from Visual Studio will use that because they've got all these productivity features. I love ReSharper. I think there's a lot of us that do. Tools like CodeRush are very excellent. If you're using TFS, it's an easier pathway if you're using Visual Studio. Xamarin Studio on the Mac, or Visual Studio for Mac now, has a lot of great features as well. Often if you're doing iOS development, the path or the workflow is a lot quicker in that situation. Mm-hmm. But those tend to be the core reasons. But often it's a personal preference. You can choose which tool you like.
Yeah. So I came from a Visual Studio background for many, many, many years, right? And then moved over and started using Xamarin Studio. And it takes some adjustment, right? It can be a bit brutal. And in fact, I'll add a few links for some really good stuff for learning how to do that transition. And now, actually, I kind of prefer it, to tell you the truth, particularly if I'm doing iOS, because you don't have to do that hop across to the build agent, you know, from your Visual Studio machine to your Mac. So if I'm going to quickly knock something out or I'm going to focus on iOS, I find that turnaround a little bit quicker from Xamarin Studio.
Yeah, I think another reason that you'd end up with Visual Studio as well is if you're running a lot of server infrastructure. If I'm doing an Azure project with a mobile client, I'll tend to stick on Visual Studio. These days, it's not as important because you've got great tooling in the browser just with Azure generally.
And I think we'll see those... you know, more stuff coming into Xamarin Studio, you know, or Visual Studio now as well.
Yeah.
Or on a Mac, that is. Yeah.
Cool.
Any other question?
If I've got a pre-existing MVVM WPF project, is there a way to sort of interface Xamarin with that? If there is a, what sort of challenges am I looking at to get it to work?
Good question. Well, the first question is often, how structured is the application? If you're doing MVVM, you've probably got good layering going on already. So your WPF should be just the presentation. If that's the case, you should be able to use Xamarin Forms as the presentation. If you're using local storage, like local file systems or local device databases, that might be an issue. You might need to abstract that away. But realistically, you should be able to take that over to something like Xamarin Forms and at least find out what the quirks and differences are between the various platforms. If you're just connecting to a REST service, getting data and processing it, displaying it, a user interface, it may not be too much of an issue. There are differences between WPF and Xamarin Forms XAML. You'll need to be aware of those. So it's not all the concepts have a one-to-one mapping.
There is actually a tool online which will take Windows Phone XAML, which is kind of a bit more similar to WPF XAML, and convert it to Xamarin Forms XAML. So, like, XAML is really just object serialization, right? So it's just going to convert the element types to different element types. So
yeah,
maybe that's useful. I'm not sure.
Yeah, not an official Xamarin tool, but
absolutely not.
I haven't seen any updates for that in quite some time, though.
Yeah.
And Xamarin Forms has gone through huge amounts of updates over the last few years. Cool, good question. And my first iOS app was a port from Windows. And it's a good pathway to go to. It's still C sharp. It's a great language. And a great way to make tools.
Cool.
Any other questions?
All right. Well, it's probably time for dinner, isn't it?
It must be. Cool. Well, thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.